This is Maria Rosaris presenting New Voices, a program which interviews brand new writers from all walks of life, deep in the throes of their writing projects. I will interview them, get them to read a sample of their work, then get a total stranger to critique them. In this episode, Jesse Hawley, a young scientist turned writer, admits he fits into the mad scientist category. Well, that's the way I saw him. But it wasn't his intensive research into the eating habits of spiders and flies that drove him crazy, but the long travail of writing a novel. Compelled by his desire to perfect his writing craft, he breaks every code of decency by asking strangers in cafes what they think of his writing. A good hypothesis, he says, that didn't quite work out. His critiquer is the powerful writer Joanne Fedler, author of 13 books and a writing mentor with a legal background in trauma, domestic abuse and human rights advocacy. Would she find much to engage her in this young man's work? Well, yes, she did. Ah, yes, she says, writing is a madness, but there is a method and art to it. And Jesse's method in his story, she gives it top marks. Join me in this episode to learn some subtle arts about writing and listen to a couple of writers who are reveling in the craziness of trying to craft out life and hope and healing in words. Jesse Hawley, welcome to the program. First post-COVID interviewee.
I felt the buzz as soon as I came in. This young gentleman.
You're a Gosford boy.
Central Coast lad.
But you're only a baby, right?
Nearly 30, yeah.
I think that you're a scientist. Is that correct?
Do a science degree, majored in biology and then did a bit of research for a year or so with spiders and flies.
You work for CSIRO?
Maybe 3 to 4 years.
Spiders and flies?
I'd since changed careers to in communications.
Why did you do that switch? Because this leads us to today where you are primarily just writing.
Yeah, very much so. I'm split right down the middle about what gives me a sense of satisfaction or meaning, and it really is science and the natural world. The nature of research is inevitably niche, and I was looking at how macronutrients affect the lifespan of flesh flies. I did that for an entire year, making near microscopic meals for flies and then measuring how much they eat afterwards. Thousands upon thousands of meals, measuring scales that you can't even imagine. I took to writing because it seems like the medium that can best express the types of emotions that I wanted to create and other people share some of the more significant feelings of being a human.
Why do you think that writing is a place where human beingness is best expressed?
I guess that's a pretty big question.
Oh, sorry. Do you want a really small question?
Just shallow talk to me. I mostly deal in the shallows. No, I'm all about getting to the essence of yourself, what you think about and who you are and your thoughts and your fears, paranoias and dreams and all these things. And it's such a pleasure when you find someone who's honest. You're reminded that you're not alone on the rock spinning around the sun. I don't know, it just feels so nice, and it's just like a spiritual cuddle. When you're doing other forms of expression, be performative in writing, what is on the paper, there's nowhere really to go. It's just you and your human experience to try and attempt to connect.
And do you feel you do connect?
I'm still trying to overcome obstacles of humility and openness. But writing, I still have these internal obstacles of fear, like I want to present myself as being maybe clever or creative or all these different artificial personas that I want to put forward. So I'm still working to erode those and write honestly. Still trying to find, I guess, my writerly voice somewhere between beautiful writing, because I do love beautiful writing, and also speaking authentically.
And you were saying, find your voice, you actually have breaking down your ego.
I keep a diary and there's no artifice there. There's humour in it and there's irony and there's still poetry. I'm just trying to capture that personality and bring that over to my fiction writing, trying to break down 29 years and 9 months of...
Which isn't very long. So there isn't a lot there. So I think it's a very advanced way of thinking. And you've been working 5 years on a novel, your magnus opus.
I suppose it's just a coming of age in relationships. It's the first true encounters with love and relationships. I found from personal experience that the end of a relationship, either being broken up with or breaking up with somebody else, and the pain received, all the pain delivered. That period there where you're alone, I don't think there are many better opportunities to rewrite or re-understand yourself. I want to try and capture that experience. Most of the 5 years, apart from actually learning how to be a good writer, is assembling this infinite jigsaw of my own creation that gets ever bigger.
Does it have a name?
Working title is Weather With You, like a Crowded House song.
You always take the weather with you. Sorry, it's that Gosford accent.
Ouch. I'm a little bit obsessed with collecting reality. I do drawing and things occasionally, and but even when I'm doing cartoons, I can't caricature things. I just like wind up doing like photorealistic depictions of things. Perhaps self-defeatingly obsessed with capturing reality.
Why self-defeatingly?
It's a fool's errand. It's impossible to capture reality. Reality is wonderful and beautiful. And
it's a bit like an impressionist painting.
We are perceiving our own work of art. You have to do that through the eyes of a protagonist.
Is it comic?
I'd like to think I'm a roughly amusing person to be around. But when it comes down to writing, there's very little humour. It's quite miserable and dramatic. I think I'd like to introduce humour.
I can see you like a scientist. You say, I need to insert a sliver of humour in here.
Yes.
Well, on that note, let's get a little sample.
I'm going to read a short story that I just finished.
Is it the dog story?
It's the dog story, yes. You've only listened to it once.
Because you had done it in a first draft. Of all of a week ago.
I've got no job, so I have ample time to redraft.
Just as a note to the listener, we've got a genuinely unemployed person.
Genuine unemployed.
Because you came back from England and then COVID hit.
Thanks a lot, COVID. Taking advantage of all that spare time to read and read and read and write and write and write. In the last few months, I've been reading Chekhov and James Joyce and some of Richard Yates' short stories. It's rather nerdy. I counted up the pages of all the short stories it is and then graphed them out. It's an attractive graph. I should show it to you after. So many benefits of short stories. You can finish something, which just feels great. Another thing is you can give something someone to read rather than just a random fragment in the constraints of a short story where you do have to make somebody feel something and you do have to tell a story. Mm. You can't beat around the bush and languish for years and years trying to write a novel with absolutely no idea what you're doing.
Yeah.
Like a mad person.
Yeah, like a mad person.
And
yeah.
No one is going to help you or save you.
No.
I think I was one of those mad people for 3 years or so. I need honesty.
Yeah.
And I will pursue it aggressively. I've got lovely friends who will give me consistently positive feedback.
Yeah, because they love you.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, so quite happy with that setup. I've even, as creepy as it sounds, approached strangers in a cafe to be like, I'm writing something. Can you stop what you're doing and read this?
That is very creepy.
And it's been mortifying for both parties on both occasions. This is where the madman aspect comes in.
Dog story.
Okay, so the story is called Sansa. Returning home from work, Christian found his apartment to be a degree or two colder than outside, like he did on most nights. He took a Red Bull from the fridge while he waited for the heating to kick in and drank it in the shower. For all its mechanical hubbub, the aircon did little to warm the place up. Was it this cold at his parents'? Lying on the couch afterwards, he considered checking the settings, but when he saw the remote in its cradle across the room, itched his back and checked his Instagram feed instead. He caught snippets of posts that spun by under the indolent kick of his thumb. Someone from primary school beaming beside his new fiancée. Puppy in the park. An update on the virus. Another dog curled on a bedspread. The naked tanned back of a girl splashing in the surf, maybe on holiday. He continued to scroll, considering, then abandoning what else he might do for the evening, growing tense with restlessness. It was the same thing every night. He rolled over, found the TV remote, and watched 5 minutes of a program before returning to his phone. Christian used to spend most nights of the week feeling oppressed in the bedroom of his parents' house, using the contents of their most recent shouting match, normally something about his attitude, to fuel his fantasy of living alone, that by engaging in uninterrupted stretches of gaming, or by eating, masturbating, and sleeping according to the natural rhythms of his body, some primal oneness might be found. He soon discovered, though, that living alone was quite different. For one, sitting quietly on the couch night after night, conflicted between sleep and tears, the urge to game, or masturbate, felt as remote and infantile as his old bedroom. "You've got to give these things time," his mother had said when he'd returned for the weekend. She seemed to disregard the 2 long months Christian had already given it. "Once you're working and into a routine," his father added from over his iPad. What did he think Christian did during the day? Back at home with them, Christian's loneliness burned into resentment. Ticking clocks, crockery, and laborious conversation. How did he put up with this for so long? And how naive could he get, thinking he could be comforted by them? It came as a surprise to Christian, as much as anyone else, the next day after lunch when, instead of fending off another of his mother's shameless offerings, "What about these wine glasses for any special visitors?" he got to his feet, saying, "Nope, nope, nope," and pushed in his chair with an accidental excess of force, leaving his mother and father to watch in helpless bafflement as he left the room shaking his head. On his way out, he spotted a photo of Lolly the Labrador beside him as a little boy in pyjamas, then both surrounded by the tinfoil litter of Easter eggs. He left the photo behind, but that night, crawling into bed after pizza and a movie, he recalled Lolly and the way she used to sneak to bed with him, snuggled and warm, and he'd giggle when his mother would enter the room whispering her name to the darkness, with no sign of movement except the bashful wag of her tail beneath the covers. Contrary to his parents' predictions, nothing much had changed in the intervening months as Christian, now finished with his phone, tossed it and the soiled napkins away. He replaced his waistband awkwardly, feeling somber again, the inciting Instagram post in question now a buxom and fast-fading memory. He unmuted the TV and closed his eyes to rest. Music and the sounds of fun bubbled down from the apartment above, where once he'd seen two girls emerge, laughing. But these soon combined with the voices from the TV to ferry him off to sleep. The next day at work, Christian was sprung googling puppy breeds by his co-worker Addie. "That's rad," she said, before he could form a flustered response. Her underarm, tattooed with the phases of the moon, rode in and out of her sleeve as she gestured and told him that everyone else was doing it. She was so cool, with her husky voice and nihilistic take, that Christian sometimes yearned to capture and somehow transmit footage of their exchanges to his school friends back at home. "Yeah," he said, turned hopefully from his computer. She was texting. "Yeah," he said again. "You reckon?" Eventually, she finished up on her phone and said decisively, "Screw it. You do you." And there it was. Christian laughed, elated. If the puppy wasn't going to happen before, it was now. "Screw it," he said to himself. The coronavirus struck swiftly, and by the end of the month, he and most of the city were working from home and in lockdown. From its first mention, the notion of lockdown had troubled Christian, for it was being in his home that he had come to dread. The long, listless nights with nothing but his gnawing loneliness for company, nights that lockdown promised would swell to engulf his days too, all of which would have come true if he hadn't bought a new puppy, Sansa. She would come running to the call of her name, clumsily from some nook, her claws unfamiliar with the kitchen tiles as she skated towards his high-registered call. "Sansa! Sans!" He planned on getting a cavoodle, which were popular, before discovering the Havanese. She was preciously tiny. Able to be scooped in a single hand, she'd squirm and lick at Christian's fingers with a vigorous, dabbing tongue. And with her sleepy eyes, shining like buttons behind apricot eyelashes, she had jarred foot traffic on their way home. The first weekend was a whirlwind, like bringing home a baby. Vaccines, puppy food, bedding, toilet training equipment, even driving home. What do you do with an 8-week-old puppy? Do you sit her on the floor? On a seat? In the end, Christian wound up with her body vised tentatively between his thighs as he drove, working through the muddle of instructions he'd received. She can meet new people, visit new places, but not new dogs. Can dogs catch COVID? The mounting responsibilities suffused Christian with that familiar sense of his being a child out of their depths. On one of their first nights together, he awoke with a start to the sound of Sansa's plaintive crying that reverberated as though in a chamber. She was in the bathroom. "What is it?" he asked of her silhouette roving in the moonlight. She continued to cry, apparently oblivious to his presence. She double-took when Christian sat down, almost looking through him, as though he were, in her eyes, immaterial. When eventually she came over, he massaged her velvet ears with his thumbs and spoke soothingly, though he felt hopeless. "What is it, huh? Do you miss your mummy?" She circled back and in the gloom licked at his fingers. He grew dozy, cross-legged on the cold floor. It was the same every night for weeks. Drained and desperate, Christian planned on offloading her to his parents, temporarily. But by the time he organised a visit, the COVID restrictions dissuaded visits to the old and vulnerable. Like everyone else, he just had to get on with it. And he did. Ploughing on with work from home, his days filled with Sansa and laptops and purposeless trots around the apartment, through a kitchen that had never been so clean. And while the face of the world's clocks grew inscrutable, overseeing the dissolution of days and weeks to soup, for Christian, it witnessed them assemble, in time, to a workable routine for himself and Sansa. Christian was returning from the shops one night, months into lockdown, thinking of calling his parents and putting an end to their weeks-long pestering, when he heard Sansa crying from up the hall. It resounded. He pictured her poring over the draft beneath the door, collapsing in wretched heaps along its line. For God's sake. She went hysterical when he entered, and as he stowed the groceries, nothing he said or did could change it. When Christian video-called his parents, he was caught off guard when they addressed him. It wasn't the tone of long-suffering parents, but one touch with formality, like that reserved for a serviceman or an accomplished relative. There was no judgment, no platitudes, just an unbroken reel about themselves, the backyard birds they'd seen, their saintly neighbours who had cooked and delivered meals to their door. They were commenting about the tidiness of Christian's home when Sansa interrupted. After her anxious wait alone, she couldn't resist her master's face, distracted and wholly accessible, and so started looking for his mouth. "Stop," he said. "Stop! Except for this," he informed his parents. "She's great, just such a handful." He tapped her snout in reproach and she sneezed. After the call, he relaxed on the lounge and scrolled Instagram. Flicking through the posts, he noticed something. Everyone was at home. The introvert memes about lockdown, staying indoors, maintaining social distancing. "I've been training for COVID my whole life." The conspiracy theories, the video stories, all were told from indoors, and as he scrolled, a lightness rose in him, a burden alleviated. He could just picture the entire city, the pubs, the bars, all empty. Even households were banned from hosting parties. The girls upstairs? Silence. Only now, in its absence, was it clear, society's grand imposition, that one must be somewhere with someone, doing something to qualify as having a life. And here it was, abated. At this odd epiphany, he felt chuffed. Still, he thought, as he paddled the stream of Instagirls, he couldn't ignore the fantasy he'd had since getting Sansa, of walking her at the dog park and bathing in the circuit of light, perky exchanges promised there. He got an idea. He opened his phone's camera, turned it to selfie mode, and tried to rouse Sansa from the doze she'd since been lost to. Sansa! Sansa! It wouldn't take long to find Addie's profile either, he thought, trying to excite the sleepy pup. He worked the camera's focus and light settings, whispered her name and blew her fluffy ears to coax out her playfulness, while at the same time training her attention forward on the lens. Once she got going, her toothed and breathy frenzy helped draw out his own natural-looking mirth. And once Christian got the shot, a dozen, he tried to calm Sansa down, but could not. Whatever he said, she persisted in licking and biting at the source of air, his mouth. Licking and biting, like he'd reprimanded against for months. Frustration soared as she, still writhing and licking, clambered up to his shoulder, to his ear. Will you just... That was it. In one vicious movement, Christian vaulted to his feet. He did so blindly and in sheer exasperation, with no intent to harm, he'd later argue to himself. But as he lunged upward, his shoulder brought Sansa riding up too, claws clenched and bracing before she was bucked from its 5-foot crest. In the stomach-turning moments before she collided with the floor, Christian recalled a pang of malintent and his forfeit to cruelty. He groped after her, but was too late. Showered and seated in the lounge later in the evening, Christian resumed the PlayStation game he'd recently bought. Sansa was in his lap, having been drawn out with merciful ease from her hiding place beneath the coffee table by the side of her owner on the floor and on his knees in supplication. For brief and unpredictable bouts over the rest of the evening, Sansa got to soothe herself when Christian was neither playing nor sipping from a can by licking the warm, damp funnel formed by his semi-closed hand. And Christian, at peace and lost in play, forgot, for the moment, to post their picture online.
Jesse, it's been great interviewing you.
Yeah, thank you so much. Had a great time.
And now on to the critique part of our program with Joanne Fedler. So Joanne, isn't that amazing to
Very
hear a young guy?
Mm. There are some young people who just can get under the flap of things.
Yeah.
He's got it.
The one thing I can't deny is that he's a writer.
Oh, right. He's a beautiful writer.
I can't imagine this guy in 10 years' time.
You can see that desire to understand things. He's taken from his scientific background and he's applying it to the craft of writing. You know, I studied linguistics and it's an invisible architecture that some people understand inherently. He's got such deep desire to connect emotionally and to understand himself, which is what brings us to writing. What,
as he says, my human beingness.
That is what art does. It makes us human.
Which is what he was saying. Is it more than just being an atom spinning on a rock around the sun?
Right. And isn't that also just such a beautiful way of expressing it?
Yeah. And yet it's wrapped in the modern mood.
That's so interesting that you used that word mood, because for me that was the word that I wrote while I was listening to him. There is something quite disaffected, the whole tone of this piece. From the beginning, I had this feeling of tension, almost dread, and a low-level anxiety. There was just something about it that was just uneasy, which is such a subtle, sophisticated ability, because it does build up this picture of somebody caught in this disaffected time, feeling isolated.
I saw two things that he showed us: being disaffected, a sense of loneliness before COVID was illegitimate. During COVID, there's a reassortment.
That is true. I think he's done that so well. Yeah. As you say, you know, there is a much more of a sense of it's okay because it's happening to all of us. Whereas, you know, that feeling in that first half is just there's something wrong. He really does capture that feeling of young people.
What I find wonderful about Jesse. He looks at the reality and he says, well, these things aren't right, but he still finds joy.
That caught me by surprise because I felt that this story was winding down into tragedy. You know, when
bracing yourself.
Yeah, I was bracing myself for that something terrible to happen to the dog. The way it ended was it was such a light touch and brings us back. There he is in the moment with this dog. There is joy in this moment, and he even forgot to post on Instagram. It's such a beautiful moment of presence, a moment of this moment is real.
Yeah, This masterful. Is
it really and is. It was really so well done. I know he said beautiful writing is important to him. This is beautiful writing because it is pared back, which you can tell is somebody who has taken time, weighed each word, weighed each sentence, understands that there is structure to storytelling, but it's not obvious from the way he writes. You know, sometimes you learn the art of storytelling, but you can really see that they have plotted it out and it just becomes like a gear change, you know? Oh, right, now's the critical point. Now I can feel that grinding down into another gear. But with him, it just was a lilt to it. He's got a very clear eye on the fact that he's writing for a reader, whereas I think a lot of young writers forget.
It's almost like they're writing to themselves.
That's right.
Notes to self.
That's right.
There was a kind of detachment with the personal relationships, but with the dog, the silky ears.
I actually wrote all of these things down, the apricot eyelashes. You know, it is exquisite. And, you know, when I teach writing and I teach voice, which is the hardest thing for any writer to get right, including myself, having just published my 13th book, it is so hard to get voice right. But you start with the senses. You start with describing the exact dimensionality, the sensuality.
It's like the nucleus of an event. Yeah.
And you just build it up. It's the sense, emotion, memory, and then the little flourish of the writer is always to reflect and make meaning.
About wanting feedback, like that is so important to him because he wants to have that interaction with the reader.
Because, you know, I was thinking about his desire for honest critique. Anyone ask me to give them critique, my first question is, who is this for? If somebody says, look, I've just written this. This is my experience of having been held at gunpoint because I'm trying to heal from this experience.
Yeah.
Somebody's just looking for witnessing. Completely different to somebody who's saying, look, I'm submitting this to a literary magazine.
Who do you think Jesse's writing for?
He's definitely reaching young people in his people, as you say, who've grown up with podcasts, who've grown up with technology, are a little bit lost in this new world. People who kind of are longing for connection. I think it is our children's generation.
Because I think every generation's got its own challenges.
True.
And I'm glad there's somebody like Jesse out there who's looking at the world joyously and sensually and mapping it and wanting to collar you so that you can listen to his story. And that's actually the next thing I'd like to talk to you about as a craftsperson as well as a writer. That thing about lack of feedback, lack of instant gratification, lack of acknowledgement.
This art form is not for people who are obsessed with instant gratification. But I have to say, every email that I get from a reader, I value so much because everything you've given to the world and then the world going dark and silent and you're not knowing, did it arrive? Writing a novel, as Jesse says, you know, is such a kind of commitment of insanity. My first novel took 10 years. You really are not doing it for the money. You're really not doing it for the fame. You don't have any idea if it's going to be worth and yet. It's almost like birthing children into a world that we don't know what the future is going to be for them.
And it's a vote for hope.
It is. Do you believe that writers should commit to writing towards light, especially in dark times?
Absolutely. What about his obsession with capturing reality?
I don't know that it's about capturing reality. I think about capturing an authentic emotion as it is passing, trying to hold it. It's almost like trying to catch the water in your hand. And for that 1 second, you might think, I had it. It's that little flicker. And it's how it was for you or for that character in that moment. He's taking a snapshot in time and it sort of shimmers and fades.
Yeah.
The ephemeral nature of it all.
Tell me about you, because already we've picked up that you've got 13 books under your belt. So expand on that, please.
Look, I started out as a lawyer. I got a master's degree in law from Yale and worked for many years in South Africa in the violence against women sector. I helped draft new domestic violence legislation. I set up a legal advocacy center. We emigrated from South Africa in 2001 and came to Australia. And during that time, I didn't know what I could become in this new country. So I finished that novel, which I'd been working on for many years, and it was picked up in South Africa. And then I began to write and I got picked up by an Australian publisher. My books seemed to hit a note, particularly in Germany. So I was writing honestly about motherhood. Book of mine, Secret Mother's Business, sold 500,000 copies, which was astonishing.
That's extraordinary. But how absolutely wonderful is that? Bizarre.
It was wonderful. So I've just finished my 13th book, which is called Unbecoming. This one is about the empty nest and about midlife.
Is the 13th book easier than the first?
Oh, God, no, this one was the hardest of all, Marie. Honestly, I cannot tell you how many times I just thought, I don't know that I can do this. And it was commissioned. I had an advance by my German publisher. I had to finish it. So incredibly hard. But I think it's also because I am quite over myself. I'm sort of quite over the sound of my own voice. It's one of the reasons why I spent a lot of time developing online writing courses and mentoring others and helping other people to write. I've written enough.
But you love the craft of writing.
The belief that storytelling
yeah.
is a tool of healing, and particularly healing trauma, the way we were talking about how under language there are these invisible structures. I think we all come with these invisible traumas that we've inherited, and that writing is one of the ways that we can actually resolve. I can't remember who said the quote, but something like trauma travels through families until someone is willing to feel the pain.
Wow.
Often writers are those people who sort of put their hands up and say, I'm going to feel the pain on behalf of my family. I'm hold it like a crucible and transform it into something. When you can then say, well, this is what I did with all that pain. I took it, I crafted something which is now in service to the healing of other people. You've done the greatest act of service, the greatest generosity that you could bestow on others. Got to cross the bridge, as I call it, between the personal and the universal.
Yes.
It's not about, you know, rehashing your own pain, and it's about transmuting that story into something that can help someone else. The important thing to remember about your story is that it's never about you. It's always about other people. It's always about your reader. But you must use your experience. It's the tool you have in order to connect.
There was one part we didn't pick up in Jesse, which in order to become a good writer, he feels like he has to completely break down his ego.
You really are asking people to tap into their vulnerability. And what happens in the course of that, as Jesse said, is you are peeling away layers. And some of us are more resourced to hold whatever opens up in that space. But sometimes we actually don't know what is going to come out.
Yeah, so there's courage there.
Especially when I teach writing, I think what I am teaching is vulnerability, like courage to be vulnerable. And the craft just flows from that, because when you tap into that authenticity, what you write will ring true, and you don't have to worry so much about the craft. When I teach, I focus on what I call your consciousness, because everything you write is a reflection of who you are and how you think. If you are an asshole, if you are an egomaniac, it doesn't matter what you have to say. Okay, is what you
actually
write.
The readers does stop listening.
Absolutely. It's such a paradox, because the one thing that I teach people is that what you have to say matters, but it has to matter to somebody other than you. And that's the thing, is to get out of that narcissistic loop of thinking that every thought you have, every idea you have, every memory of yours is relevant. It is only relevant when you cross the bridge between the personal and the universe. You know, when I finished this book, I was so relieved. I felt like it was like I'd been through like a baptism of fire. But I felt like I have honored something real and true about this stage of a woman's life. That felt good to me. And so much so that if people come to me and say, I didn't really like that book. You know what I think, Maria? Then I didn't write it for you.
Oh, that's wonderful.
Yeah. It will touch people that it is meant for. But if you didn't like it, first of all, absolutely fine.
Amazing.
No, not at all.
So where are you now?
I've started a new literary imprint with Karen McDermott of Serenity Press.
I read
Lusaris.
About that. Yeah.
And that,
what advice do you have for him? Important.
We want men who can write into emotion. Mm-hmm. You know, these are wonderful role models for us. And so what I would just advise him to do, let his writing speak for itself, because this is a young man, I think, to watch. I think he will, no question, he will be published, and I wish him the best of luck with it, because his writing is so beautiful.
Joanne, thank you for being on the
program. Thanks, Maria. Thank you for inviting me. That was fun.
And that was the powerful and wonderful writer, Joanne Fidler. This is Maria Rosaris, and it was a pleasure to bring you this program, produced in the Sydney studios of 2RPH with the support and inspiration of the Community Broadcasting Foundation. I look forward to your company next time.